Prometheus steals fire from the gods and gives it to humanity. We have this story of divine heroes, of new amazing technologies, nuclear power, controlling the atom, all this kind of stuff, as compared to the Salmon Girl story, which is more just an ordinary person who brings knowledge from nature that enables people to live more sustainably. That's the sense in which the hero is you. It's like bringing knowledge to share with other people. It's about us being everyday protagonists in a natural world of which we're a part.
This is Frontiers of Commoning with David Bollier.
The centralized market state system is in flux, if not teetering. Climate change is battering humanity, and social and political unrest are intensifying. Is collapse inevitable? And what would come next? Today, we're going to talk about an author whose vision of the world goes beyond collapse and liberal modernism, a radical localism built on small-scale farming, eco-stewardship, and commoning, among other things. His new book is called Finding Lights in a Dark Age, Sharing Land, Work, and Craft. My guest is Chris Smage, a former academic sociologist at Goldsmith University of London, who gave up life as an academic to become a farmer and champion of agroecology. Several years ago, he published A Small Farm Future, a book about the virtues of small farming and its role in building local economies that have distributed eco-minded ownership and governance. In Finding Lights in a Dark Age, Smage takes this exploration further. Working from the premise that societal decline or collapse is likely, he focuses on how ordinary people might step up to the challenges of the coming, quote, dark age, as he calls it, with some irony. What would agriculture, land ownership and use, livelihoods, household and family life, and politics look like? Smage's book is not a doomer or survivalist tract, or a prediction or a blueprint. It is a serious analysis of macro political and social trends and thoughtful speculation about how existing projects and movements might evolve and build a new type of decentralized world. Chris, it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
Maybe we should start with the arresting image that you open the book with. You start with an imagined nighttime flight over the continental US and England to provide a kind of sweeping aerial overview of what civilization looks like in a very different post-collapse age. Could you tell us why you started with that kind of imagined flight and explain what it revealed?
Yeah, the introduction starts with that flight. There's actually a preface where I go back to the Vikings and start there and kind of frame our whole modern frameworks in terms of a kind of extractive, colonial, predatory violence, which I think is a little concealed in our day-to-day lives in places like the US and Western Europe. So yeah, that flight was sort of designed to show how that's been concretized in the way that we live, and particularly the balance between urbanism and ruralism. If you fly over the United States in particular, you see these huge urban concentrations where most people live, and then flying over the Midwest, the High Plains, this massive agricultural production. And all of that is tied together by abundant, cheap energy, by fossil energy, and it has tremendous effects on climate, nature and biodiversity, and is not, in my view, sustainable in the long run. So yeah, I sort of began with that flight to say, you know, here we are in these, you know, very, very fragile human ecosystems. Los Angeles, I think, is the second biggest city in the US, and it's not necessarily where you would choose to concentrate millions and millions of people in view of water and of other biophysical realities. So yeah, it was designed to suggest that we're kind of skating on thin ice, and we don't really have great ideas or great politics for how we're going to get out of this. We need to start thinking in terms of shocks and sort of unscripted systemic breakdowns, I think, are going to be part of the future.
So what did you see on that flight that is different in this post-collapse era than what you might see now flying over that geography?
People historically have always sought, moved to places of the greatest peace and prosperity. historical processes that have led to the kind of distribution of populations and land uses that we see in the contemporary US or Western Europe have been complicated and quite coercive often, but nevertheless, basically, peace and prosperity has been urban industrial in recent times. I'm not sure that's going to be the case in the future. And I just mentioned Los Angeles already. Earlier this year, we saw huge wildfires in Los Angeles, in places that were centers of peace and prosperity and sort of relatively stable life, are not going to be like that in the future. And so I think we are going to see people moving within and between countries. We're going to see systems of delivering welfare, whether we're talking about food and social services, breaking down. We're going to see, I think, lower energy systems and much more challenging biophysical conditions. And so I think there's going to be a great deal of population movement and a great deal of turbulence to the very globally interconnected, these sort of huge high energy supply chains that deliver most of the welfare and benefits and the sort of perquisites of daily life. Food systems is a particular concern of mine, but everything else as well. You know, I took this kind of lofty vantage point in the opening part of the book, partly to excuse me from trying to predict or exactly model in fine detail, because you can't do that. But I think you can spot what some of the larger patterns are, which is what I tried to do.
Well, you call this a dark age. Tell me why you dubbed it that. You at some point said there was a certain irony you were intended, but nonetheless, you're playing with that idea.
I've raised the idea of the Dark Ages for various reasons. It's partly that I don't really see any likely politics, any kind of mass politics anywhere that's going to get us from the situation we're currently in to a more stable, low energy, agroecological, sustainable human ecologies. So I think that's going to emerge out of system shocks, systemic shocks and breakdowns and collapses of one kind and another, a bit like previous dark ages, when existing state forms and existing economic and trading systems broke down. What comes down to us in history is elite voices saying, oh my God, you know, everything's falling apart around our ears, isn't it terrible? But for ordinary people, dark ages were often beneficial. Evidence here in Britain is that when the Romans left, archaeological evidence of nutrition of ordinary people is that they were better off, you know. So I sort of play with that idea and the fact that so many of our narratives come from, are dominated essentially by elite narratives from state centres, which are quite invested in the status quo. So a dark age isn't necessarily that dark. There's also a biophysical playfulness, I suppose, in a lower energy society. We're not going to have as much light and energy of one kind and another.
To the extent that the point is to get reconnected with the earth and eco rhythms and systems, that's going to be very different from capitalist modernity.
Yeah, absolutely. And the difficulty I think we have is that past dark ages, just ordinary people had the means of production. You know, they were fairly connected to the ability to produce a local livelihood in the way that isn't really the case for most of us in the modern world. In your preamble, as you said, I'm not trying to be a sort of doomer and say we're all screwed, you know, let's just go home. But I think we do have to be aware of the gravity of the situation. And this isn't just, oh, well, things will get a bit tough, or, you know, let's hope for a bit of new technology that will fix it all. This is a really fundamental problematic crisis that we will face in many different ways in different parts of the world.
One of the things that I found so compelling about your book was that it stepped outside of what you call liberal modernism. I could only think of a handful of authors who really rigorously go at that, people like Ivan Illich or David Fleming. You have to be outside of the political mainstream to even bring that discussion to the table. So maybe you could clarify what you mean by liberal modernism and how that is vulnerable. If not, we might have to move beyond it.
Well, partly it's about the kind of stories we tell ourselves, which, well, the modernist story is really a kind of progress, historical progress, which is quite unusual in world historical terms, the notion that we're going to be better off than preceding generations, that we have more and more control and power over the world. And to some extent, that has been true in recent generations. but palpably it's increasingly not true now. And many of the ways in which we have gained power and control are now coming back to bite us, climate change, energy futures being an obvious example. So partly it's a critique of that Promethean heroic story of human overcoming over natural limits and so on. There's also the great power of the centralized state, which exists across the mainstream political spectrum, whether we're talking about left-wing ideas about the state providing services and sort of intervening to provide welfare backstops and manage social tensions, or the state corporate alliances that generate modern market arrangements on the right. There's this very, impoverished individual state relationship where you're looking about sort of capitalist states or socialist communist states, that there's a kind of leveling of all the complex kinds of human institutions and associational life in between the individual and the state, you know, that's just mediated, you know, by the market or by state bureaucracy. So I think there's a whole complex of things there about the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and where we're going, the means that we do that through politics, and particularly through sort of massive collective centralized state politics, that is not really serving us well ultimately, and it is going to come to an end. And yeah, in a way, this is all quite new stuff for me. I'm very much a child of that kind of liberal modernist tradition. And, you know, you mentioned people like Illich and David Fleming as well. I've slowly been kind of heading into that sort of camp and looking for alternative traditions to draw on, having very much grown up within the liberal modernist one.
I found a quote in this regard quite condensed in making this point. You write, "There's a fantasy in all this that the hard work of provisioning ourselves can be costlessly offloaded onto other people, other places, new technologies, and exotic forms of energy. But we can't keep buying ourselves out of local ecological relationships with nature and with each other in this way," basically the modernist way. Maybe you could elaborate on that and how some of these macro trends are simply not sustainable.
Now, obviously, there's the biophysical side of it with this extreme global dependence on fossil fuels. Some people get excited about renewables and so on. I'm quite unconvinced by that transition. The whole sort of global system at the moment is very dependent on abundant, cheap energy that gives us vaster, greater power and control than has ever been the case before.
Just to intervene, you're not convinced of renewables because it doesn't deal with growth. It's simply another energy source, but it doesn't substitute for fossil fuels necessarily.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it. But I mean, essentially, if you look at where we are globally at the moment, generation or consumption of renewables has increased a lot in recent years, but it hasn't actually substituted for consumption of fossils. It's merely added to it. There's a whole bunch of different aspects of that, sort of geopolitical, and also renewables can do quite a good job of generating electricity. There are the sort of hard to abate sectors which actually are really critical for the of modern lives lived not close to the ecology or the land. You know, steel, plastics, fertilizers, and cement, all of these things are pretty hard to decarbonize, to not use fossil fuels for.
We were talking about how these macro trends are unsustainable, and you were starting with the biophysical.
So I think it's not exactly a zero-sum game, but I mean, basically, the way that we buy ourselves out of having to be formal ecological protagonists within a local ecology is through things like fossil fuels, which is essentially a short-term deal, which is damaging the climate and damaging nature also, but also drawing down on other people's labor in hugely globally interconnected economic systems. An example I give in the book is the Thai fishing industry, where used to be a fishery that Thai people themselves were involved in. But then with economic development, fishing is hard and dangerous work. So if you are participating in the over-monetized global economy, there's other jobs that you can do. But the result of that is that people from poorer surrounding countries, labor gets drawn in to do these difficult and dangerous jobs. And because they're poor people from other countries who are not connected into local social networks, labour conditions are very poor, in some cases essentially slavery. And so we're offloading onto nature, we're offloading onto other poorer people. And ultimately what we need to do is generate sustainable, real human ecologies, and that's going to involve us doing the hard yards locally in terms of providing for ourselves. If we don't do that in a designed, planned, careful way ahead of time, it's going to happen by default in all sorts of potentially more troubling and violent and hard to control ways. So I guess that's what I'm trying to sound the warning now about in the book.
I want to get into the particulars of your localist vision in a moment, but one final topic on this idea of liberal modernism. How is the liberal nation state and the liberal political philosophy implicated in all this? Because in some ways, a lot of people say that's the basic structure that we all rely on or look to. It's unimaginable to move beyond liberalism, except in authoritarian or autocratic ways. How do you see liberalism implicated in getting to a benign post-liberalism?
That's a big question. I mean, in terms of the nation state, I guess I would say that it's a relatively modern creation, which in some ways has arisen out of competition. There were the European colonial powers, Britain and the Netherlands, particularly fighting it out over global dominance. And then in the 20th century, we've had the United States in particular sort of taking over that role. And historically, there were many, many other forms of political power and forms of social organization. The modern nation state is classically thought of as emerging out of the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, which created this sense of single central point of sovereignty. And I guess my argument really is that we accord too much power to those centres. You know, we accord too much power to Washington, D.C. The history of the states is interesting, I suppose, in the whole federal state structure and the history of that in relation to the Revolutionary War against Britain. But nevertheless, even in the states, there's a sort of little bit of a historical hangover from that. But essentially, there's a kind of federal power, a central power, and that is the nature of the world that we've inherited. But yeah, part of what I'm trying to argue is that that's only one way of organizing things, and it's a relatively recent way. And particularly other countries that weren't in the front rank of these colonizing powers kind of invented their nation statism. There's this whole period of nation building in the 19th century with the invention of us national vernaculars and national literatures and histories that overly emphasize the unity of the nation. I guess part of my argument is that we need to stop taking those so seriously. We need to create some other stories. What we need to be doing is making ourselves and our localities more unique and interesting, and making ourselves the hero of the story, as I put it in the book.
Maybe let's get into these new narratives that try to validate and make culturally resonant the idea of localism and a local life. You use the term that the hero is you or is us as kind of a grounding point. What do you mean by that? And let's talk about how that manifests in land, agriculture, money, and other realms. But tell me, why is the hero us?
Well, I was drawing a really interesting book by Philip Loring that was quite influential on me, called Finding Our Niche, where he draws a lot on sort of indigenous North American culture and livelihoods. And he has an indigenous North American story, which was about a young girl who falls in a river and drowns. And then the mythological structure of the story is that she spends many years with salmon in the river, the salmon teacher tell her how they want to be treated, how they want to interact with people. And she's then reincarnated amongst her people again and is able to explain to them how the salmon want to be treated. And that enabled them to have this sustainable ecology of human-fish relationships longer term. It's a very different kind of story to the Promethean story, the story of Prometheus, who steals fire from the gods and gives it to humanity. So it's like we have this story of divine heroes, of new amazing technologies, nuclear power, controlling the atom, all this kind of stuff, as compared to the Salmon Girl story, which is more just an ordinary person who brings knowledge from nature that enables people to live more sustainably within a kind of existing complement of animals, plants, the world around us. So that's the sense in which the hero is you. It's like bringing knowledge to share with other people, which is not some great insight that nobody, you know, the idea of scientific triumphs that ordinary people like us can't understand that bring down from on high. It's about us being everyday protagonists in a natural world of which we're a part, that we seek to understand and be a part of, but not to over-dominate, not to destroy, not to create too much linkage. Humans are great. It's our kind of superpower is we have all these symbolic systems, language, religion, money, you know, by which we can connect and sort of create greater flow than can really be sustained in the local ecology. And that is who we are. We can't not do that. So you're not arguing that we should just be salmon or whatever. But I think it's about learning not to use those powers too abusively and learning to limit them and to understand our place in the world, which is where I think the hero being us rather than some great mythological of semi-divine of hero is important.
In your vision of an agrarian localism that's decentralized, empowered, and people have greater creative agency, how does that Salmon Girl story manifest? Why don't you tell me some areas where, I suppose notably agriculture, but other areas of town life or trade or land ownership, how might that manifest?
Well, I mean, a sort of agricultural example would be, you know, if you have small scale local land ownership or husbandry, you know, you tend to find quite a mixed, diverse set of interconnected agroecologies, which will typically involve trees and woodlands, grassland, usually with ruminant animals cycling nutrients, and a small amount of cropland that would typically be vegetables and some starchy staples. So you'd have a diverse, whole food, healthy, nutritious economy, which basically it tends to create a mosaic landscape of mostly woodland, grassland, which is, you know, relatively benign. And that's where humans really fit into the ecological picture as creators of sort of semi-open mosaic landscapes. But if you push at the system with high energy, heroic interventions, what you tend to get is a little bit like that picture of flying over the United States that you mentioned I start with in the book. You tend to get concentration of arable crops in certain limited breadbasket areas of the world, of which the central United States is one, where you are cranking out vast amounts of wheat or maize or soy using high energy, quite destructive mechanized techniques, or drawing on relatively exploited labor and then sort of adding value by turning it into biofuels or livestock feed or whatever, and creating a whole bunch of pollution problems and agrochemicals associated with that and so on. So that's the idea of small-scale land ownership, that if you give people their head just to produce for themselves or for their communities, you don't really get that. I mean, yeah, you get arable crops. You know, crops like wheat and soy are great for a whole bunch of reasons, but they don't get out of hand and over-dominate. you know, trading wise, again, its basis is to sort of trade for things that you would like that you can't necessarily produce so easily in your area. But nevertheless, you've sort of got a basic level of local self-reliance. It's very different, which actually was kind of the arguments of Adam Smith, much as he's kind of presented as this pioneer of modern global trading systems and the invisible hand of the market. All that, you know, it's quite a distorted view of what he was actually arguing, which was for diverse, productive national economies. And we can then talk about what national means. And I mean, as we just were, is it the nation state, or should we break it down to smaller levels?
I assume in trying to think about a non-capitalist order that's not as extractive or externalizing of costs, that things like you mentioned guilds and commons as a way to help reinvent the local economy and even have positive spillover effects and communal effects.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that dynamic of these bottom-up livelihoods and how it prevents the kind of top-down manipulations, predation, and so forth that we see right now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was quite influenced by David Graeber and David Wengrow's The Dawn of Everything, where they make this point that there's a way of creating local self-government that has been quite ubiquitous in world history. But as soon as you get that kind of Viking top-down domination and sort of predatory kind of economies and political systems taking hold, it can be quite hard to stop them. But in the absence of that kind of predatory system, you know, people are pretty good, I think. I mean, obviously, you've written a whole bunch on this kind of stuff. People create quite effective systems that make the most of where they have to work together locally to produce things. And that can be whole landscape level land management, or it can be systems of essentially social security, of methods of sharing. Guilds are a good example of craft or trade specialization, where the idea is that the craftspeople are fairly compensated for their expert work, but it serves the wider purposes of the community. It's not like a trade union or a trade association whose aim is unenlightened self-interest of its members to extract what they can. It is set within a sense of a wider common good. So yeah, you know, that's the basic structure of it. And likewise with commons of many kinds, it's the fact that people have to come together at some level to determine best use of a resource and best forms of rights of appropriation and collective action. And I suppose in the particular context we're at now, going back to the earlier part of our discussion about states and over-centralization, I don't see this as something that is going to be delivered top down by normal politics as usual. I think the way it's going to happen is that the sorts of things that we've become accustomed to getting via these sort of state corporate big supply chain stuff are going to start breaking down, and people are then going to have to start innovating at the local level to make good the shortfall. This is the kind of thing we need to be thinking. You know, we need to be thinking about food systems and managing energy and fertility and systems of care and systems of property rights. So that's what I'm trying to point at in the book, a blueprint for a blueprint.
You point very usefully, the shift is not about managing need, but about creating capability. It's capability, not just in a general sense, but in a bottom-up, the hero is you sense. And then you also had a very interesting set of 4 points of transition, which I found very resonant, about how the goal is to remoralize the market, which you contrast with the amoral markets and scientific principles, relocalize the economy, recapitalize the poor, the small farmer, and the small business, and reinvigorate and relocalize the political order. I mean, that's a very succinct summary of a lot of things that interrelate to make localism more viable, if not synergistic and constructive.
Yeah, I was drawing there on John Medai's book, Towards a Truly Free Market, which is a sort of articulation of distributist principles, which again is one of those frameworks that I've only come to relatively late in life, but I think is important. And it's that kind of getting a more complex relationship between the immediate and the local and the larger scale, but not assuming the larger scale, bigger isn't best. bigger is necessary to manage certain things, but it's important that things are done locally where they can be locally. Things are delegated to people. That's the emphasis on the ability of people to solve their own problem at the smallest local level possible, but to set that within bigger structures.
Maybe you could give me a more direct description or definition of the distributist principles. What does that entail? How does that play out?
I guess a key idea is subsidiarity, which has become a political buzz term in some contexts, but it basically means that you allocate to the lowest, smallest, most local level. Everything that can be achieved at that level is done at that level, and then things that can't be done at that level then require higher level organization. We're just talking about small-scale farming. That would be a case in point where basically producing the crops that you need for your household or your family, you do as a private individual thing, so that there is some wider level agreements about individual households, families having access to land, you know, having appropriation rights over a bit of land in order to produce their food. But there are some things that better lend themselves to collective organisation, so woodland management, for example, or forms of grazing management, where it doesn't make sense for everybody to have their own field for one cow sort of thing. I mean, I talk about one historically here in Britain, Cheddar, quite close to here, where people would own cows individually and milk them and make hay for them, but they would be grazed collectively and cheese would be made collectively in a creamery because it makes more sense to do that as a form of organisation. Now, there's a lot of economic complexities behind all that. You're allocating rights to small levels which enable people to be autonomous agents and to think through their own issues and produce things for themselves, but not to the exclusion of making more sensible use of the wider farmed landscape, and for that to some extent to act as a social security net.
I've always found subsidiary to be a very compelling idea, but I've also found it implausible within the liberal capitalist system because there's simply too much money to be made by consolidating, centralizing, controlling. This leads me to invite you to talk about future types of state power that could perhaps be hospitable to subsidiarity. You talk in your book about the possibilities of, this is maybe not sympathetic to subsidiary, but authoritarianism, autocracy, feudal capitalism, even warlordism based on a regional basis. What sorts of arrangements of state power might be hospitable or supportive to subsidiarity? And after all, the state is not going to go away. It's a question of how it's going to be reconfigured or mutated or a hybrid. What ideas do you have about that?
The emphasis there is on the word state, and I'm not sure that there will be forms of state power that are hospitable to subsidiarity, because the very nature of the state really is to sort of claim a monopoly of economic control. I'm not all that confident that this will manifest, that the outcomes will be great in many places, but we could see a kind of techno-feudalism and massive levels of state authoritarianism spreading. But I think that states will be increasingly unable to control all of the narrative and control all of the territory. So, you know, part of what I talk about in the book is this idea of open country. We're talking earlier, I said about, you know, population movements and people finding their way to places that were more propitious for well-being. And interestingly, those places are not always the places that states are most interested in or most able to co-opt and control. So I would see this in many ways emerging in the interstitial zones between states, where states fail, where they potentially break down, which I think will be more of a future reality. I mean, the subsidiarity idea in many ways emerged out of Catholic social teaching, out of papal encyclical Rerum Novarum at the end of the 19th century, which is kind of interesting in the sense that that Pope Leo the 13th, I think, you know, in many ways it's quite a conservative document, was arguing against this liberal modernist idea that either we have the market that individual people have no control over, but in theory is supposed to provide goods and services to us, or we have these sort of massive socialist state forms of organization, these huge bureaucracies that provide things for people. The nature of subsidiarity in Catholic social teaching is that, yes, we do have these wider politics, but the idea is to give ordinary people access to a bit of land that gives them some security from the larger machinations of the state. But your question, I think, is how realistic is that? The state is always going to lay claim, or potentially lay claim, to geographical territory, to people's labour. You know, people like James Scott, I think, the late political scientist, argued very interestingly about this sort of stuff.
The Art of Not Being Governed was a notable title, and Seen Like a State.
Yeah. That's The Art of Not Being Governed is probably the most resonant title of our discussion. As people are quite inventive in generating local livelihoods, they're also quite inventive in keeping the state at arm's length. And I think this is maybe a context for our discussion where modern Western countries, we've come to this view of the state or government as quite benevolent, that it looks out for us, it provides services. But for a lot of people historically, the less you had to do with the state, the better. And yeah, you know, The Art of Not Being Governed, that Scott's book was about upland areas of Southeast Asia, where people pretty much went there because they could avoid the lowland grain states that were very exploitive, and found ways to create quite interesting kinds of political systems and economic systems in the absence of the state. You know, that doesn't seem very realistic in the United States or in Western Europe today, but my argument in the book is that that kind of thing is going to become more possible, and we need to raise our game, I think.
It's been pointed out that a lot of the state-sanctioned exploitation, colonialism, and so forth has been turned inward domestically because it's no longer possible to do that kind of external predation as much. There's, of course, a kind of a neo-colonial exploitation. It strikes me that there might be a more crisis point when domestic populations realize that the state is not going to be there to support them either, and trying to think through what this might be. It seems that there's a lot of discussion about whether the state can be salvaged and under what terms. Some people have a faith, I think of George Monbiot and his ideas for industrializing food production with microbial protein, for example, seems to have a faith that the state can be a stable enough force that some form of industrial capitalism could save the day.
Yes, I mean, my previous book was actually a critique of George Monbiot's stuff on microbial protein. And the reason I wrote that book was essentially that Monbiot has great credentials as a sort of radical thinker of the left, and yet suddenly he's embracing this highly technical corporate high energy solution. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that we can get into, but basically, people across the political spectrum are reaching for techno fixes because it's hard to see how we're going to keep the existing political structures of the world on the rails otherwise. And it is scary to contemplate what will happen if we don't do that. So there's this real impetus towards rapprochement with high tech, high energy, corporate business as usual, even from people on the left. That has been a trend in recent years with writing on the left, you know, fully automated luxury communism and all these kinds of ideas. The left always has had that kind of modernist sort of emphasis on technology and state control, but it's just becoming, the microbial protein thing just doesn't stack up on energetic grounds, quite apart from anything else. So,
and yet there are those who say that, as Monbiot apparently does, that small farming is not going to be able to provide enough food, and therefore in the industrial solutions and modernist solutions is the only way to feed the 8 billion people of the world.
Yeah, people do say that, but I think it's based on a misconception that sort of small-scale, low-input or low-energy-input farming is not necessarily that unproductive on a per-acre basis. It's unproductive relative to industrial food systems on a per-labour basis, per unit of human labour. So the problem is the transition. It's not that we can't feed the world necessarily with sort of small-scale agroecological techniques. It's that we don't really have a politics or a sort of economic narrative that
I see
that makes it seem feasible to transition from where we are now. And the way we've transitioned out of more labor in agriculture is essentially through agrochemicals. You know, it's through fertilizers and pesticides and so on. Partly they're fossil fuel dependent, but also they're having a tremendously ecocidal effect. So somehow we need to get people back on the land producing in small scale local ways. And, you know, that doesn't have to mean that everyone's spending their whole time being a farmer. There's a gradations of amateur production and allotments, backyard gardening and so on. But we need to be keying ourselves into that way of thinking. As I said, I think this is going to arise through crisis. On my little farm, we run a little local veg box scheme where we grow vegetables that we sell locally. When the COVID pandemic hit, suddenly the supermarkets, it was a temporary supply chain issue, basically. They ran out of fresh fruit and vegetables. They had the commodity crops. And so all of a sudden, normally get sort of one or two requests a week for new customers. All of a sudden, we were getting like 100, 200 new requests, which we couldn't meet from our little farm. We did our best. And then, of course, it didn't take long before everything was back to normal and we're back to one or two new customer requests a week. But my argument is that we will see more of those kinds of interruptions to supply chains, which will be longer and deeper and more chronic. And that kind of thing is going to drive, or at least I hope it will drive a rethink. All of these kind of high-tech microbial protein kind of stuff, these ideas, they tend to be based on massively high energetic inputs that substitute for human labor or for solar input. And, you know, ultimately, that's an argument that's relevant here, is that the sun provides all the energy we need, but it's diffuse across the planet. And so historically, people have been diffuse in order to tap that. And we've kind of bought our way out of that only in the last century or two through the availability of cheap fossil fuels. If you take the view that we can substitute fossil fuels for other sustainable long-term high energy alternatives like renewables or nuclear or whatever, then yeah, you know, maybe the existing structure is sustainable. You know, we then run into other problems of waste and pollution and ecocide and so on. But if you take the view that we can't really replace fossil fuels, we either scorch ourselves through climate change or go into a kind of energy descent path, which I think inevitably will mean more people being distributed more widely over space and more local food production. So I'm arguing that we need to do that sooner by design so it doesn't happen later chaotically by default.
It reminds me of how in thinking about solutions, there's so many unwittingly modern presumptions built into the answers. And I loved your quote from the Lorraine who said, only in the industrial colonial way of thinking do solutions for producing food or managing environments need to be uniform, scalable, and deployable to all corners of the map. The idea of how it scales through this unified unitary system versus diversified local small scale, in some ways that's a parting of the roads, one road versus the other that we were talking about a moment ago. I think that so much about your book is opening up the imaginative space for the small scale and local as a realistic, feasible solution, albeit under some very different premises.
Yeah. You know, in agriculture, you've got so dependent on this handful of arable row crops. Wheat, maize, rice, soy probably be the key ones globally. And these are things that are scalable, not to everywhere. And that's part of the problem. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, we've got more and more dependent on this small number of global breadbasket regions, which tend to be semi-arid continental grassland regions that have a lot of issues coming towards us in relation to climate change and water access and so on. And obviously there's industrial production that does tend to be more scalable, but again, in a way that relies on high energy and sort of abstracts, you know, takes from us our ability to generate more local, more sustainable solutions that put us more at the center of the story. So I do think that you're right. It is a parting of the ways. There is this Elon Musk wanting to take his space rockets to Mars or whatever, new frontiers of colonization and humanity getting bigger or better, versus that idea of the salmon girl, versus that idea of understanding how your local ecology works and how you can lead yourself into that and be a protagonist within that.
I want to thank you so much, Chris, for your probing, thoughtful opening of imaginative space. on what a localized, agrarian, green, non-capitalist world might look like. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, great talking with you.